Hey, welcome back to the show. Today I'm joined by Luke Sutton, former professional cricketer and now agent. In this episode, expect to learn whether an athlete can be too nice to the opposition, how sledging in cricket can be a good thing, understanding men and its complexities, how young men need good role models, how to show vulnerability with strength and courage, the importance of how vulnerability is received when men show it, and much more. Hey, do you mind doing me the biggest favor? And that is hitting the follow or subscribe button on whatever platform you're listening to this show on. It is the cheapest and easiest way in which you can support the show. By doing that, it raises the profile, it allows us to get more guests on, and helps create better, interesting conversations for you guys to listen to. So your support is super valuable, and I thank you so much for doing that. In other news, if you are suffering with low self-confidence, or you perhaps know someone who might suffer with low self-confidence, then I have just released my self-confidence game changer. This is a totally free 4-part video mini series. I'll be sending you 4 emails over 4 days, each with a video and a worksheet that you will be able to work through on an exercise designed to help bring you more self-confidence. So if you would like to receive this free mini-series, all you have to do is click the link that's in the description of this episode, and I'll send it straight to your inbox. But on to today's episode with Luke Sutton. Enjoy. Luke, welcome back to the show. It's great to see you.
Thanks for having me back. Good to be here.
It was a long time ago. I think even the last time I did an episode with you, I was in Australia. So it's been wild. As you know, we'll get into the world of podcasting. When you put one out every week, and I've had a bit of a hiatus recently, just had some time off. But when you put one out every week, everyone says it, time flies. But like when you do a podcast, time really passes quickly.
Well, mate, then when you first contacted me again, I still thought you were in Australia. So that's
yeah, you did actually, yeah.
That just shows how quickly it's all flown by. I was like, okay, we need to make a time difference work here, and then you're like, no, I'm back in the UK. I'm like, oh right, great.
How's the summer been for you? I want to actually talk about the summer of cricket, because I haven't had anyone to talk to about. But how's the summer been for you?
But summer was brilliant. I loved it. On a personal level, I had some really great time with the family. The cricket was—it's hard to describe actually. The summer of cricket, both both the men and women, it was phenomenal. But it was the men's Ashes. It was just insane. I mean, it was like a sensory overload. But especially, I have to say, I think for all fans, but for people maybe like you and me, it's definitely someone as old as me, it like literally attacked every sense I had of what was right and wrong in cricket. And I was in various different WhatsApp groups with mates who are like, oh, this is great. And I'm like, no, this is insane. You can't do this. And then it's like, no, this is great. And it was just, oh, mad summer. Enjoyed it though.
I think it was like a movie. And we were, one moment I thought, so for people that are listening that don't know cricket, don't know what we're talking about, we're talking about the Ashes that happened this year between England and Australia. And it was definitely revved up as one of the biggest series I'd ever seen. Well, 2005 was probably revved up after the series. Like it was about that unfolding and that what happened in that series, and we winning the Ashes in 2005. And then all the team there have gained such notoriety because of the stories that came from it. Whereas this one was more ramped up pre Ashes. One, because of the social media, I think the social media effect was wild. The amount of insight you got, Bazball playing a role in it, the style of cricket that England are playing, the Australians being strong and want to contest against that, believing old traditional ways can win as well. And then the actual games being, every game being a blockbuster, every session being a blockbuster. And it was just like a film. And I was exhausted after, but in a good way.
Totally. I had a friend of mine who said, you know, can you describe Bazball? So, you know, Bazball, for people who don't understand cricket, is essentially a style of cricket that the current England team and their coach is Brendan McCullum, who's nicknamed Baz, and hence where Bazball comes from. It's a style of play. And I had a mate who said, how would you describe this in, if it was football terms? You know, like, how would you put that into. And I was like, that is a great question. And I'm going to go with it's a little bit like playing 11 attackers and no goalkeeper. It's that level of kind of they are pushing the boundaries, or not just pushing, they've stepped over the boundaries of what is deemed sensible. I don't even know, it's not even remotely sensible, but cricket's such a statistics database game, isn't it? Like a baseball. And that, so everyone unconsciously or consciously is driven by percentage, isn't it, of risk and chance, and literally they just blew that out the window and just did things which should make no sense. And suddenly it did seem to make sense.
I think the beautiful thing about it, though, was that Australia's way also worked, and that they
True.
started to, they pushed back and they said, look, you can play one way, but we're going to play our way, and we still believe this is going to win. And if I'm honest, like, one, I think that whole series was a great learner for the squad. If you look from outside and you need to put your professional cricketer's hat on, like, you can say that was a great learner. They'd made some mistakes in the first couple of games, and probably were too aggressive in some moments, but it was a great way of showing one adaptation, being able to adapt your game, having that adaptation, but then also that any sport, like, just don't talk about cricket, that it can be played in multiple different ways and you still get the same outcome success. I mean, their point in Bazball is that we're trying to put bums on seats, which I actually love. I love the idea of them trying to actively go out and entertain, because there's people they misinterpret the sports industry, that it's a sports industry. It's an entertainment industry. It's all about eyes, right?
Yeah, it is. I mean, it is amazing that. But I think there's also there's the tact. It's a tactic. It's a mentality. You know, they pick players who will fit for that mentality, and you know, players who don't, you know, aren't in the side. And there's definitely, I think of that declaration that Ben Stokes made in the first Test match, which, you know, essentially made zero sense. You know, there was nothing that would justify what he was doing, you know, this tactical decision he made. And you know, that I for like wrestled with that, just going, that was wrong. They lost that game, and that was a massive mistake. And I, you know, my old school kind of thinking was coming back into it. But my mates from, you know, cricket fans, or not even from, they loved it. And we were talking about it all the time. And yes, it was entertaining them, but I think it was also a message from Ben Stokes to the opposition, saying, you know, this is what we're going to do. We're just going to keep coming at you in the most aggressive way, and we're not going to stop. And you're going to have to put up with this or not. And that's why then the series became so enthralling, because it was like, you know, England being a boxer just throwing punches, and Australia being that little bit more, I don't know, not careful, but a little bit more tactical, I guess. And then in the end, they drew, and it was amazing. But it was like this tug of war of aggression and defense and aggression and defense. And I think that it just made fascinating watching.
It's almost, the sad thing is that we're going to have to wait so long, well, in our eyes, so long for the return fixture back in Australia, because I think the group they've got now, obviously there's a lot of them playing in the World Cup, but you just want to see them in Australian conditions and what they can do there, and give them the freedom of the ball not moving around that much, and it just being probably one of the first times that an England team would go over there and feel probably very strong in the batting unit. The batting unit being the one that probably is a bit of a, I guess, changing of the guard with the bowling unit, and then being probably the box seat in the squad, just with the sheer stack of players they've got and the way they play and the ability, and Stokes, how long he's going to play for. And they've just released the central contracts and he's only taken 1 year. What did you make of the central contracts that just got released recently? The first time, for people listening, it's the first time they've released multi-year contracts in cricket, where the England players can be on a more than 1 year contract.
It's a massive sign of the changing times of the game. You know, it was central contracts up till now have been, here's your central contract. This is what we're grading you on. Are you going to take it? And you know, 999 times out of 1,000, that player would sign it. Maybe more. You know, I can't think of a time where someone wouldn't accept a central contract. This time, because of the changes in the game, and essentially that England or the national governing body wanting to keep players playing for England rather than them being tempted to go off into, you know, play in different leagues and essentially give up international cricket, have had to respond to it, which has brought all this bargaining power back to the player. So where there was no bargaining power, you played for England, you're not going to go and play for another country. You know, here's your central contract, great, I'll sign it. Suddenly it's like, well, I don't want to sign for 3 years. I want to sign for a year because I don't know what's going to happen in a year. Maybe I'll want more money, or maybe I'll go do something else. And that's never happened. So it's fascinating to see how, you know, certain players have committed for 3 years, and a Ben Stokes only a year means, you know, arguably the biggest box office player for the England management and executive. They're going to have to renegotiate with him in probably 10 months' time, which is not a long. And if you know, it will be interesting to see how it all plays out.
It's almost like the power dynamic of shifting from institutions, the organizations, to the players, similar like football, really. Like, you think about players, yes, they sign these, well, I almost would say in football, a 5-year contract seems to not really mean much. You could be moving on in a year, but the guys see in football and the players in football seem to have that bargaining power. They can just dictate what's going on, and that's never happened in cricket, and it's now happening. But what a time for the game. It's just been an amazing, and even for the women's game commercially, like, had a bunch of women's cricketers coming on here, and just the excitement around that game, both opportunity wise, but then obviously from then on the back of that, there's commercial opportunities, there's the earning opportunities that they've not had before.
100%. And I'm lucky to manage a couple of the current England women's players and the captain, Heather Knight. And what, you know, the arguments around the 100 are pretty ferocious. And, you know, people sit one side of the fence on whether it's good for the game or bad for the game. But I would say for the women's game, the 100 was, in the first year, was an absolute game changer. By putting them on the same time as the men, same ground, increased the crowd, suddenly the whole excitement around the women's game increased exponentially. And then they had a great Ashes summer. They've been playing really well. The interest and just generally women's sport, and then the broadcasters getting more behind it, showing it more, giving it more profile. The Ashes was marketed as a dual Ashes, wasn't it? It wasn't the men's Ashes or the women's. It was the Ashes, which included both of them. And I think they're gaining the benefit of it. The women's game is absolutely flying. I just one thing, just going back on, same with the women actually, but going back onto the baseball and the men's Ashes. Do you think we're just blessed with a generation of exceptionally talented players who can do this, or do you think the mentality is getting the best out of the players? And you know, that's what I don't know.
So I've got a fact. Baseball was actually inspired my research in my degree, and probably some areas that I'll go into. So I'm looking at running a research project on perfectionism and perfectionistic environments, but also the perception of the athlete on the coach, and whether the athletes believe that the coach's perfectionism put onto them will create fear of failure, lack of risk taking, and potentially, what I'm trying to figure out what the word is, and if there's anyone listening can maybe help me out, is what I'm trying to name this performance autonomy, which is sort of like your authentic way of playing the game. The way I would describe it is, if you're say a player who's facing a spin bowler in a game, and you know that authentically to you in your mind, your right option for you to do is to run down the wicket and try and hit this guy for six because you think that's the right thing to do, and you doing that would be sort of living your most authentic performance. But if you've got a coach that's creating an environment that they're putting, saying, I want you to be perfect, and I want you to play a certain way, or don't take risks, and if you get out, that's a bad thing. then does that environment then create the player to then go, okay, well, actually, I'm not going to go down the wicket. I'm going to play a shot and try and score another way. But in doing so, say, gets out. And then how many times have you seen where that person is then in the shed and then they're going, oh, I wish I'd done that and I wish I'd taken that risk because that's what I really wanted to do. So I want to study that and the environment in what they're doing and creating. Now, you also have to have the talent of player and the ability in the player to know that running down the wicket, taking that risk, is you have the ability to do it and you can go and do that. And I've had James Bracey on the show recently, probably a few weeks ago, a couple of months ago, and we spoke about, does this format of the game and the way in which they're playing, is it changing? Because I'm not in the game anymore, and I'm not on the field. Is it changing the way batters are trying to approach? And you saw players like, I remember seeing Rory Burns like running down the wicket in a county championship and he had his stumps cartwheeled and it was like April in a game. But it was clear, it kind of showed this expression of like, okay, maybe I've got to make a move because if I don't make a move, am I going to get left behind as a player? And my chances and goals, like every player that's playing county cricket to play for England, are those going to get smashed away? And it's a really tough one. I don't know whether you've got this climate, this environment that the coach is creating that is creating this fear of failure. Maybe he's completely changing the way England cricketers look at cricket forever. And don't fear this failure. But I think within it, there is an element of we can still play this way, but adapt with players that are of high quality coming in, regardless of the way they play. Like, would Brendan McCullum turn down Alistair Cook right now or when he was in his prime? Would he done?
I don't know. I think it's a great question that. I mean, you get a young player who's played Test cricket, Haseem Hameed at Nottinghamshire. Very, very fine player. He doesn't fit the mold of this team right now. He doesn't, but he's an excellent player. And in another generation, he could have played it. He could play 100 tests. He might still play 100 tests. I don't know. But he doesn't fit. I also wonder whether Bazball is a perfect storm of coach and captain. And if it wasn't that, I don't know if it would. You've literally got two. And Brendan McCullum and Ben Stokes, two people who view the game the same. And they're so strong about it. They're not kind of like, well, we'll see how we go. It's like Stokes every time, this is how we play. This is what we're going to do. I'm not going to apologize for it. You know, we're great with it. And his coach backs him up 100%. And then Stokes goes out there and plays in that way. And he almost spent 12 months with the bat. Showing it, didn't he? Where it wasn't actually really clicking for him, where he's playing crazy shots, almost showing, listen, don't be fearful. It's okay. We've got this. And in a player like Zach Crawley, you know, that him and the coach are just like, this guy's going to come good. Don't worry about it. He's brilliant. He's going to come good. And sure enough, he really came good in the Ashes. But maybe you need that coach captain axis to be, as it is at the moment, it's like perfect symmetry. If it's not, it maybe doesn't quite work because there's that little bit of doubt where the coach or the captain's like, I'm not sure right now. And then that feeds into the players and changes the environment.
Well, we might be looking at sort of the class of 96 of England cricket. You look at Manchester United, right? They dominated for so many years. And it's like a perfect storm of players, manager, culture, everything. And it's a completely different story from them right now. That's probably why you get eras in sport. Like, we're going through currently an era of the game. It's about how long we're blessed with it and we get to enjoy it. And when players naturally start to move on, it's, I guess, the inner sanctums, I'm not in it, but the inner sanctums of the English cricket game have got to try and find a way where you don't let it drop off and you allow it to maintain, even if it's done in a slightly different way. Yeah, it's a challenge. One thing I did have an interesting wanted to throw your way was this series was the nicest contested series I think I've seen as well. Like, the players was friendly. At previous, or it was in my eyes nicest. You just saw that there was joking, there was laughing, there was guys that were pally. Obviously, franchise cricket and playing in teams around the world plays a role in that. Where do you stand on playing the game hard on the field and it being almost too nice and there not being enough competition and also not allowing that competition to roll over into ruthlessness, aggression, and I'll probably get onto sledging in a minute as well.
Yeah, well, it's a great question. I mean, there was obviously the Bairstow stumping incident, which sort of blew up a bit. And where was that? Was that Lords or can't remember? Yeah, yeah. It was at Lords. That obviously kind of made things a bit lively. But yeah, I struggled watching it a little bit, you know, and I totally accept that this could be my own shortcomings. Like I'm not sitting here going, it's not right. I'm just saying it honestly as a player who played, you know, for nearly 20 years in the pro game, watching players be that pally with each other before a contest, it didn't sit well with me. And I was talking to my son's a really good hockey player, and we were talking about it yesterday about different things going on the field and, you know, how to handle himself. He's only 14, he's playing men's hockey, and how to handle himself physically and mentally. And I was like, well, you know, sometimes you need to just drop a shoulder or just let them know you're there, or, you know, that kind of thing. And I could hear myself going into that place. And I don't know. I feel maybe I need to be re-educated on it. And I, like I said, it might be my own shortcomings, but I feel like you bring an energy to a competition, you know, that energy doesn't go with you everywhere. You know, I'm a puppy dog with my kids and away from a competition environment. I really am. I'm the biggest pushover of all time. But when I come to fight or compete, I bring an energy, and it's that energy. I need that contest. I don't even think I would react well to it being too pally. I think I'd find it a bit destabilizing. And so when I watch it, I couldn't get my head around it. But they play unbelievable cricket, and you know, England should have won the series really in the end, you know, and it was probably a nice result for it to be a draw. But I don't know, there was a bit of me going, I'd just like to see a bit more, a bit more dog in it, if that's the right phrase.
Yeah, well, when the Lords incident happened, I was like, good. Like, this is, I'd almost got to a point, and I'm so the same as you. And while I think we're marinating ourselves nicely into some of the other topics we're going to talk about, but the contest between, and like Stuart Broad coming out and acting the way he did, just, I was like, right, this has got the fire in it now that I think exactly what we needed, whether it was the way we were playing at the time or whatever, but just there's the whole hype around the series was Australia v England, and then you get there and then it's like everyone's handshaking and hugging each other at the toss, and like I'm just sitting there going, right, well, you're totally right. There is a time where you can turn one part of you on and turn another part of you off, and then turn another part of you on and the other part of you off. And yeah, I think I would have been the same, where if I'd seen that, and again, this could be my own shortcomings, like you said for yourself, but it's like, if I see that, I feel like there's a chink in the armor, like there's a chink in the process, and it's like you've given them something, or you've shown them like an unwillingness to sort of fight that little bit when you need to fight, which is on the field and be contesting and be that, for maybe the wrong word, tougher, like to be hardened.
Yeah. During those times, I was fortunate enough to manage Jimmy Anderson for a long time. So, I know him as a person, as an athlete inside out. And I was really interested watching him when, you know, some of this, and he was never involved in it at all. And I, you know,
sounds about right.
Yeah. I just thought, there's no way Jimmy's going to go fist up. No way. You know, for him on the field, it's just absolute war. You know, he crosses that line, and hence why in his career he's had problems where, you know, he's not held it in, and it's gone, you know, he's crossed the line and got into trouble. But I don't know, it just, man, it doesn't feel right to me. It just is like, I know it's cricket and it's a gentleman's game, and there's, you know, if people who are not used to the game would look at it and see it as being quite ceremonial and very gentle and, you know, tease and all that kind of stuff. But I don't think in Test cricket or in high level cricket, there's a sport which examines you for as long on a real mental level, you know, like mentally. It's just, you know, we played first class cricket 4 days, Test cricket 5 days. It's literally examining you mentally that whole time. And that's why it's exhausting. because it's just going, have you got it? Can you handle this? Can you handle it? It's that pressure cooker of it's pressing. And the best are the ones who just outlive that pressure. They're just like, yeah, I can do this for 10 days, let alone 5 days. And there's others who break in that time and they suffer. And that's what it's all about. And I feel like when I watch you, what you were saying is, are you giving something? Is there a chink? I feel like when I watch it, you're giving a bit of yourself to the opposition. And I think that I don't like that. It feels dangerous to me that, you know, in that mental examination, I want to keep everything inside me.
Yeah, I think that also plays a part of like eras and where society is as well. And I think, so talking about it being a hugely mental game, one thing that I had read an article recently about, which was sledging in cricket, and this article was about how damaging it is for not only the person sledging, but also for the sledgee, the person who's being sledged. Now, for, again, people that don't understand what sledging is essentially, I've almost don't know how to describe it. So on-field conversations that are designed to put the other player off their game to give yourself an advantage by breaking their thought patterns, whatever it might be. Now, the way in which that's done is a vast array of things. Some people can be borderline personal, which is where they would cross the line. But other than that, the majority of the time I've seen it can be quite comical. Now, the person that was writing this article and the article itself was, I read it and it was all about sort of how toxic it was essentially. And I then text a range of different people who were professional cricketers. And I was like, what's your view on sledging being in the game? Do you think it's a good thing for you? Do you think it's a bad thing for the game? And all of them unanimously came back and said, we don't care. We think it's good. We think it actually tests your resolve. And it's up to you to deal with it to the best of your ability. It's actually almost like a metaphor for life, really. Like, can you deal with people saying nasty things to you? Where do you sit with sledging? Because you've played the game for a lot longer than I did. You played it in an era where I reckon it would have been even rifer because there weren't been as many stump mics and things like that where things get caught up. Where do you sit with sledging, whether it's a good thing or a bad thing, especially from a mental development point of view?
Yeah. Well, the first thing I'd say is that I'm always willing to be educated and to learn. Like, if someone can show me a different way, I'm listening. I'm not going to be stuck going, this is the way it's always been. This is what I think. Not at all. I'm open. But I agree with what that feedback you got. It's part, what is sledging? Sledging is mental intimidation. That's what it is in cricket. It's essentially, is that any different in aspect to, I don't know, Roy Keane and Patrick Vieira lining up in a tunnel ready to go and them staring at each other saying, I'm ready. Are you ready? So, you know, is it any different to that? And it's on a cricket field, definitely people crossing the line and saying personal things, that should never happen. You know, if it bubbles over in that way, the reality is that the game corrects itself. You know, umpires will step in. Even teammates will go, whoa, calm down here. You don't need to go there. But if it involves essentially me saying to you, listen, I'm up for this. I'm ready to go. I'm up for this battle, and I'm going to test to see whether you're up for this battle. What's wrong with that? That's life. It doesn't mean that we're bad people. It doesn't mean that we take that, like I was saying, that we don't take that energy into back home to our families. It's not. It's just there's a, you know, I think there's a primal thing. It's kind of like we're here, we're part of the tribe. We're now fighting and to see who wins this contest. And we're essentially bringing everything to the table, our skill, our mentality. That might come into what the words we use during the game. And if you're not up for it, I'm probably going to win. And I can't see how that's a bad thing.
I had one of my my first class debut when I went out as night watchman on batting. I think Andrew Strauss at the time, England captain, was there. It's a pretty intimidating arena that I went into. And people were, as I walked out, they knew I was on debut. I knew I was going to get some things said to me. I was told that I was going to get my fingers broken. I was, my technique was terrible. I looked ridiculous in what I was, my kit and whatever it might have been. and you felt tiny. Like I'm 6'3", 6'4". Like I felt tiny when I was out there. But looking back and actually in the moment, I chose to show courage, bravery, and just take it on and drown out that noise and remove that distraction by focusing on what I was trying to do. And I'm prouder than anything for doing that. And it built the character that I was. I think if I'd walked off and complained or put in an appeal or whatever it might have been, it just wouldn't have sat right, and it wouldn't have said enough about me as a character. And funnily enough, the people that I reached out to, funnily enough, all asked me like, who wrote the article? And the people that were writing this weren't in the game. I had never played it at that level. And I think that is the issue, is that most of the people have it's journalists sometimes that will say something about it. And it's like, you have to be on the field experiencing this to understand it. You have to be out there 100%. To experience it.
No, 100%. And I was a wicket keeper, and I wasn't shy in expressing my passion for wanting to win that game. But don't you think that I got that back? You know, like, and when you bat, the hardest thing is it's you and your mate against 11, isn't it? So when as a wicket keeper, if you're a bit chirpy, they are waiting for you to come into bat. And it's like, here we go. I knew that. I did it for 20 years. I knew that I was going to get it back. And if I wasn't, therefore, as a character, going to learn this lesson in life, that if you're going to give it out, you're going to get it back. If you're going to, you know, this moves both ways. And if you're not prepared to do that, not prepared to handle that, then don't do it. Don't, you know, step away. It's not for you. Say less, you know, see how you, you know, get on. And I think that's really important in life. That's a kind of, you know, an example of the fact that, you know, life isn't one way traffic. It's not just about what I want and what I'm going to do, and that I want to take this and I want to take that. There's going to be something that comes back at you. And, you know, I know I'm talking about, I don't even like the word sledging, but that kind of aspect of the game is, you know, you give and take. It's war, and if you're not prepared to stand up and take that responsibility, then don't do it.
And this is where we're going to blend lovely into this, the masculinity, or vulnerability, a lot of the subjects that you talk about in your new podcast. But I think this is where it's a real, something like sledging. Again, I like the idea of mental intimidation. I think that's a fair assessment of it. It is this understanding of blending that certain part of you. That's where in those moments where you're being intimidated, where you're on the field of battle, you've chosen to walk out onto that field. You know they're going to be hard. It's a competition. It's a performance. That's why it's really important for people to disassociate between the performer and the person. And people that are on the field and acting certain ways, that's not necessarily what they're like in life. If you take it personally, you've misinterpreted the experience that you're going into. And that's where you cannot... it sounds tough. You can't be too vulnerable in those situations. That's where you have to dial up strength a little bit, and that mental strength and that fortitude to deal with that situation. But it doesn't mean you come off and then interpret the whole thing and the experience of someone trying to throw you off and intimidate you as it being a knock on who you are as a person. You have to recognize that it's them trying to win a performance, win a game, win a match. And by trying to knock you off your game, your choice is to stay strong on your tracks, on your performance, on your focus, and stay there. And then you can dial up vulnerability and elsewhere. It's not needed. It's
totally. I'm giving our podcast a great plug here, but the episode out now with a former professional cricketer, Simon Cusden. It's honestly, it's brilliant. I know it's our podcast, but give it a listen. And he explains about some research that he'd been taught about the Mayan tribe. I think it's in Mexico, where the tribe itself, the men would go out and be the hunters and gatherers, and they'd put on their armor and they'd go out there and hunt, and they'd fight against other tribes. But, you know, they'd go out and essentially provide for the tribe. When they returned to the tribe, the borders of the tribe, they'd be met by the women, who would ceremonially take their armor off, bathe them, and welcome them back into the tribe. And it was done as a reflection of, you need that energy to go out there and do what you need to do to provide for the tribe. But now you come back to the tribe, that energy is not welcome here. Now you're going to come and be a father and a partner and do those things around here. And I thought that's such a nice way of describing exactly what you're talking about. Now, I'm using an example where it's men going out and women staying with tribe. The gender part of it, I kind of, you know, can be whatever you want it to be. But it's, I think more the point is, it's about this energy. If you go take that energy out to go and win a game of cricket or go and provide for the tribe, it doesn't mean that that energy is you 365 days of the year. You know, and it's in the same way, you can ceremonially let it go and go back home and you cuddle your kids and you watch Peppa Pig with your daughter, and you know, that's it. It's different, and it's totally, can totally be a separation.
Yeah, I love that. So let's get into it. You're in the world of podcasting, understanding men.
Yeah.
You've dived into the depths of the audio recording and the video recordings. And why did you want to do that? Why did you want to start the podcast and especially name it Understanding Men and the topic that it's all on?
So we... it comes from a few different influences. I've got three sons, two stepsons and my son. And my son is 14. And also he's a twin, a daughter who's 14. But it started because I think particularly for my son and my two stepsons who are younger, I just became very aware of the influences floating around their worlds. You know, and they've grown up in a generation of social media and what that kind of looked like. And I also started to see a few young men within my family or network and them kind of moving from being teenager to being a young man and honestly sensing almost a bit of anger around them, around where they fitted in society. You know, just comments like, it's never been this hard to get work if you're a young man, type comments like that. And it kind of, I was like, where's that come from a little bit? And I sat with it, and I also have the comparison of my daughter who's 14. And I just came to this place where I was like, female empowerment in the last few years has been fantastic. I love it. For my daughter, I said it before, she's got a strong mother. Yeah, I love that. She can go out and do what she wants in the world, and I'm very grateful for that. I just felt like maybe we just left behind the boys a little bit, and there's not much influence for them, and they're a little bit kind of lost. And then they get someone who pops up on social media and says, look, this is what it is to be a man, and they gravitate to it. And we can't sit here and go, well, those aren't the right influences. I think we have to go, why are they being so influenced by those people, like gravitating and rapidly? You know, I hate bringing the name up because I end up talking about way too much, but Andrew Tate character just got massive traction in a millisecond. And we can't sit here as men going, well, they shouldn't be listening to Andrew Tate, or they should be listening to Andrew Tate. You just have to think, why are they listening to Andrew Tate? So that was a massive driver. And in Fraser, who's, you know, a real, I don't know, soul kind of connection friend of mine. We, you know, he's a professional footballer, he's a recovering addict. We're like brothers, and we have very deep conversations, and we're never shy of expressing our vulnerability or where we are as men and discussing being dads and all of that kind of stuff. And just essentially was like, right, let's do a podcast to tackle this and have conversations and try and put something into the space that we're looking at, which might be what we would feel was really good influence for young men and teenagers. And we're definitely not coming to the party going, we have all the answers. Not at all. It's not that, but we're going to explore it, and we're going to have the conversations that other people might not be having at the moment, and let them listen in on it, whether it's about sex or body image or self-esteem or imposter syndrome, whatever it might be, and go there so that people listening can go, oh yeah, I really relate to that. And then I feel like I'm doing my bit towards my sons and, you know, whatever I can do. It sounds a bit grand, doesn't it? But to society. And the title Understanding Men was, you know, kind of a play on that. You know, it's like trying to understand men. And I guess in Fraser and I, we are understanding men, you know, and we're just trying to go into that space. So the podcast is is really about all the issues for men that pop up, but they cross over for women as well. But our focus is very much about men, and I love it. I'm super proud of it.
A good friend of mine rung me a few nights ago, and she's asking for some advice on her husband. And while I'm no absolute genius in relationships, she quite literally was trying to understand this man. She was trying to understand some of his behaviors, and she could only really want to like untangle it through a conversation with a guy. She's like, I've spoken to my girlfriends and they've got XY opinion on it, but obviously they're coming from a female perspective. And said, like, can you understand what's going on with him and why he's acting in this way? And I said, well, look, if I put myself in his shoes, there will be a certain attack on his ego over here. And like, he may have been, you have to understand, he may have been hurt by something you said over here. And while there's a big rhetoric in the world around how simple men can be, it's far more complex. It really is complex. And going back to what you were saying around hearing that it's tough being a young guy right now, I totally agree. I even was in a meeting with a lady who she's got two young daughters, sort of mid-20s, and I've recently come out of a relationship, and I was talking about going out on the dating scene, and she was like, I do not envy you whatsoever. She's like, being a young guy on the dating scene is a minefield right now because of the amount of female empowerment, the amount of male, the masculinity conversation around being vulnerable as a male. Does a male make the first move? Women want you to make the first move, but you're seen as a predator if you do make the first move. There's all of this conversation that's going around. And if you listen to someone like Scott Galloway, he'll talk around how we've currently got this huge growing society of men who are not having sex in the young, in sort of 30 below, that are choosing to be single. The incel community is growing, and there's nothing more dangerous than being a young, broke, alone man. And I think it's around these messages, and not only that, like you said, the role models that are playing a part of that. I think the reason why people are gravitating to someone like Andrew Tate is because he's providing a guide. When young people are faced with someone talking around, it's okay to share your feelings, your emotions. As a young boy, with the amount of messages you're sent, it's still kind of an unnatural thing to want to show your emotions. I don't think it's an easy thing for you to do naturally. You just don't, the way our biology is built, we don't test the high levels of testosterone. There are far more greater emotions such as anger, sometimes sex drive. All of that plays a much bigger role in a young person's life. I think they're seeking this guidance. They're seeking the how-to guides of how to get this sense of strength, this sense of self, this sense of direction, and just happen to be this guy with a huge amount of money that was able to throw out a marketing sort of version of it. All right, it was toxic, but it was if you look at the premise of it, all of those young people and experiences I've had with working in schools, these young boys, they are looking for role models. They're seeking guidance and they need it so much. And if you look at inner cities where there's crime rates are up, the people I think the statistics show that if it's the people that are doing that, they tend to come from households where they've not had the male role models. They've not had those people guiding them. So I think it's guidance. I think it's that what we're seeking, which is why I love the podcast, the name of it, and what you're doing, because it'll provide that guidance.
Well, we're actually recording tomorrow morning with a guy called Matt Pinkett, who's written a couple of books. He's an English teacher, head of English, but he's written a couple of books, one of which is Boys Don't Try, called Boys Don't Try. It's a bestseller, and it was in 2019. And he wrote it because the stats in 2019 around how boys were doing in school versus girls, and this is in secondary school, so it's not, you know, there's the kind of chat that girls are a bit brighter than boys earlier on, and then boys catch up, which I think there is some research behind that. But essentially, in that secondary school age range, the results for boys on exam results, exclusions, mental health, poor behavior, was off the charts worse for boys. And this is in 2019, like off the charts, not even close, a thrashing. And that what's happened there, you know, what it, that is those boys looking for that guidance, feeling disillusioned, feeling like they're not good enough. They're not, you know, as a result of poor behavior, getting punishment and getting more disillusioned with the whole thing. And so I do think we're facing a generation of kind of boys becoming young men who face that. And I just think it's time for us to offer a little bit more help and guidance around it. And I think, you know, what we try and do on the podcast is it is about men or young men, but it's also about how it affects women. And there's that dynamic with men and women, because I think, you know, where there's a polarity, you know, there's male energy and female energy in all of us, and how we understand each other and how we move around in society is super important. And I think men, like funny you should say that with your friend, men have become even harder to understand for women, because women know what they want, what they want now. They know who they are, what they want. They've got the power. Fantastic. How does that fit for their man? I don't know, because the man's role is different now. That, you know, in some, it could look different. So they're like, well, I don't know. I kind of want you to be strong, but I also want the strength. I want you to be the provider. Well, no, actually, I can be the provider. And there's this real misalignment going on within it. And so I think part of discussing all these issues is definitely for men, but a lot of our listeners are women, like your friend going, well, actually, I'd quite like to understand men a little bit better because it helps me. And I think they go hand in hand.
Yeah, this paradox that some young men find themselves in between trying to show vulnerability, trying to be strong. And I think I genuinely believe the vulnerability conversation has had it's a huge uptick. It's a massive conversation, but I think it has left strength, which is a natural feeling for a young man to want to feel. They want to feel strong, capable in themselves. And it's understanding when to bring that vulnerability on, when to bring it out. And I found this quote by Brené Brown, which is, vulnerability is not winning or losing. It's having the courage to show up and be seen when we have no control over the outcome. Vulnerability is not weakness. It's our greatest measure of courage. I love that, the fact that she used courage, because I find in my work, especially, when you say the word bravery and courage blended with the word vulnerability, it's the words that really matter. There's a different reaction. Whereas if you just go, it's okay to be vulnerable, they go, yeah, but what the hell does that mean? Like, what does that really mean for me? And how do I show it? What does it mean about me as a character? If I am vulnerable, am I now squashing myself? Am I opening myself up to the sort of fleshy inside that could get really damaged? It's a tough one, but I think it's really important how it's framed. And I'm interested to hear from you what vulnerability would mean to you.
Yeah. So, I love that quote, by the way. Here's the thing for me. I realized that I love providing for my family. I know it sounds a really obvious thing, but I really love it. I love knowing, and I'm twice married from divorced marriage, so I'm supporting, you know, there's a wide network, and I love feeling like I'm supporting everybody. I really do. I'm not saying it from an ego point of view. I'm not saying it from I'm the big I am. I don't tell people about this other than, no, I'm not on this podcast, but it's not something I go around shouting about. But I know deep in me there's a feeling of this feels good for me, right? And I found that in where we've moved in the discussion around this sort of thing is I wasn't sure if I was allowed to say that out loud, you know, or that would be like, oh, well, that's, you know, it's a little bit sexist. You know, you shouldn't, you know, women can do that as well. And just the pause on being able to say that is not healthy. You know, the fact is that me feeling that doesn't mean that a woman can't do that. It doesn't mean that I would be delighted for a woman. I'm just saying it for me. And I think for the discussion around male vulnerability and where they fit, I think that's got muddled a little bit, and men going, well, I'm better showing vulnerability and not showing the strength of this maybe more primal feeling that I have, maybe, because that's what women want from me. That's what society want from me. So therefore, vulnerability equals weakness, because that's what people want from me. They don't want me to be, right, listen, I'm going to provide for the family. I'm going to be the leader in this family, because that's frowned upon. And there's become a misalignment. But if anyone knows anything about me and my story and what I share a ton of vulnerability. You know, I'm a recovering alcoholic. I've shared my story of how I've dealt with it. I have no issue in doing that, because I feel confident about who I am, and it fits alongside wanting to be a strong man within my family and my network. And they can sit side by side, but I think they haven't. I think they've got detached, and suddenly vulnerability is a young man might think, well, that's what I'm meant to show, and that's meant to be weak, and that's where I fit, not realizing that it can all come together.
I think only because the vulnerability conversation has taken a huge front seat for a long while, not sure, but I think you're right. There is a lot more of a softer approach from young men as well, as general. But when you sort of grow up and in relationships, the maternal instincts for women, take that, the tribe you spoke about there from Simon's research that he said he found, that there is a maternal instinct in women. We can't really fall away from biologically what women will feel naturally. And this is blanket generalization. Yes, there are strong women who will take charge of relationships. There are, but as a general across the whole, and I think there's this other voice that's coming out in social media, in the media, which is women saying, no, we want our men to be strong. We need them to be strong, because yes, I might fall in love with him for his vulnerabilities and he shows that, but if he's constantly being vulnerable when I need him to be strong, this relationship is not going to work, but this is going to break down. So I think this is where young men will have to understand there's this blend that has to happen. And sort of as you were talking, I was thinking around how that vulnerability is embraced. So if a man is showing their emotions, talking about something, the person receiving that information plays a huge role in what they do next with that person. So I know, for example, I have not shared my emotions or my vulnerabilities for a long, long time, based on the fact that moments when I'd done it, when I had opened up, it was met with, well, that's why you being different and getting sort of shut down, and you've never shown this before. Like, what is this? And that is just a small version of shame. And the worst thing for a man to feel is shame and guilt. And therefore, lock it up. Don't do it again. Like, that was a bad experience. And it will only take one or two experiences for a man to then lock the door for a long, long time. And I think that needs to be something that people are aware of in understanding men, is that how you respond to them showing these different versions of themselves is really important. The same way, if someone is ultra aggressive, you go, no, that's not how you behave. You shut that down. But the vulnerability has to be, I understand what you're saying. I hear you, and I thank you for sharing that, rather than this, well, even if it's an uncomfortable thing that you might be hearing, like if a man is sharing something about a woman in their relationship that they're not happy with, how often will a woman just say how a man is behaving and be like, you don't do this, you don't do that. But as soon as a man might say something, they get shot down. Well, hold on, you can't do that. You can't tell me who to be. And it's like, well, you've instantly shot down his vulnerability, him opening up his emotions. And how it's received is super important.
Yeah, I mean, the biggest example I can give of that is one of our early episodes that you talked about, is we talk about sex and body image for men. And I think that's a huge one for men, because men just don't talk about it at all. They feel terrified to, well, I am making sweeping generalizations, but bear with me. I think a lot of men feel terrified to bring up the fact that they feel nervous about sex, or they're nervous about their bodies, or whatever it might be, because that conversation between a man and a woman, in this case, we're talking about heterosexual relationship, how that's received, that vulnerability, and plays from there, exactly like you say, is crucial, because a man opening up to that saying, I don't know what you want, or I don't feel very confident in the bedroom, or whatever it might be. It's such an important moment, and it means that they can share that vulnerability, come away, man can grow and be strong and then be more confident. But if he gets shut down in that moment, it will crush it and it gets hidden away, and then it's lost.
That episode that you're talking around, you yourself and Fraser spoke really well around what sport, the sort of roles that sport and the environments there play. And yeah, I'm 33, but I sort of, when I went into the sport, I sort of came in with this changing of the guard from the old guard of cricket, and the old, less, it's a much more high performance environment now. Like it's, yeah. I mean, when I was coming in, it was pints and cigarettes and a lot of that going on. But then it blended into this high performance, your protein shakes, your S&C and things like that, that was really taking the front. But that you spoke about going out and the sort of infidelity, the cheating environment. And man, that was the thing. Like it was almost like this, not rite of passage, it was sort of this acceptance of this is what we do and this is how it is. And just looking back at some of the behaviors of how I was as a young man, when I got into relationships, like how I acted, because I was sort of learning this off the environment I was in. I spoke with Tom Mitchell on the podcast about how sporting environments can squash your real version of you, or mold you into a version of you that you don't necessarily want to be.
That's what happened to me. And I don't say that with any kind of anger or resentment at all, but around intimate relationships, it affected me massively. Just being in that environment, I was in the old school environment where, being faithful was just not a thing, the thing is, as I say it, I'm always feel uncomfortable because I know that, I'm like, oh God, who would be listening to this from my part, from old players that I played with, but I'm not pinning it on anyone or any team or anything like that, but it was the way it was. And if someone at that point, what's the alternative, rather than putting your arm around a 18-year-old kid saying, listen, we're not, just to let you know, in this team, we're not faithful here. This is what we do. Or you put an arm around a kid and say, listen, in this team, we treat women with respect and we're respectful to our partners and what goes on, and let's behave in with that grace and class around that. That would be the difference. And I think that has a huge impact for men going through sporting teams, whether professional or non-professional, but just those sorts of environments and the influence they get.
As a father yourself, how do you go about, or what are you hoping to try and instill into your young men that is this blend of strength and vulnerability? How do you see yourself going about it?
Well, I think the most important thing is I can say whatever I say, they're going to watch my actions, and I'm going to live and die by my actions and my integrity always. And that is, I can't even, to say it's important doesn't place enough importance on it for me. It is my life. Am I showing up every day for my family? And I mean that properly. Am I there going, what can I do to help? How can I be a leader, be of service, be a provider, be a strong person within the family? And if I'm doing that every day, then my son and my stepsons are going to go, okay, that's what a man might look like in my eyes. And they're going to get that influence rather than me saying anything, any words, that's going to be more powerful. Part of the reason of doing the podcast is a bit of showing vulnerability to them as well. So I can be that person. I can be that really strong person in their life, and they can talk. They can hear me talking about vulnerability and go, I can see both there. That's okay. If they're not separate, they're both. It can be a very strong man in the sense of provider, leader, whatever you want to call it, and also have a softer side, a vulnerability side, and they can see that blend. But I have to live it. That's the biggest influence for all of us. You'll be a father one day, I'm sure, and you have to live it. You have to live that and be that person 24/7. And if there's a sniff of you not living your words, you know what it's like. People have gone, you know, they, whether they're your sons or people around you, they're like, well, you don't live that. It's just words and they're gone.
Yeah, I just think there's this rebrand of vulnerability that kind of needs to happen for young men. And I think strength needs to play a part in it, like real strength, like not just the strength of showing vulnerability, but the strength of your character. I'm always reminded by Peterson's quote of, you should be a monster, but learn to control it. And I think that is the real strength that comes from a man, is being able to control the full range of experience that you're having and knowing when to show up in the right way. Again, the quote of, it's better to be a warrior in a garden than a gardener in a war. But you can be both the gardener and the warrior. It's just knowing when to show up, that version of yourself, at the right time. But like what we've spoken of today, the environment that you're in and the people that are receiving that person who is showing that vulnerability, showing that strength, plays a huge role in how that person then gets molded moving forward.
Yeah, totally, totally.
Look, mate, I'm very conscious of time and I've taken up enough of it. This conversation with you, I could go on. I think you've got this great outlook, and the Understanding Men podcast is out there, and you're churning out some episodes, which is great. Where can people follow along with what you're doing?
Now I know I'm going to show my technical lack of knowledge. Everywhere, essentially. We have a producer, Lucy, who sorts this all out. But yeah, it's available everywhere, Apple, Spotify. If you're on any sort of social media, Instagram, just have a look for Understanding Men Pod and you'll find us. And there's the link there and you can go. And please, you know, for guys particularly, we do want to talk about what they want us to talk about. And so a lot of the episodes have been driven by people sending us messages saying, could you talk about this? And I'd love that. So if there's someone listening and goes, I'd love to hear a podcast on this, this is important to me, find us, drop us a message privately, and we will 100% listen.
Awesome. Is there anything before we sort of wrap up that you feel is an important message for people to hear, or maybe even something that's inspiring you at the moment that you would navigate people towards?
Oh, good question. I'm just grateful that these conversations are happening at the moment. I think, you know, it's great. I feel proud of our podcast, but I feel really and I feel well nourished the fact that you and I have had this conversation, you know. And I don't know exactly where you sat with these things, and you know, for us to be able to talk open and honestly about this, it's really important at the moment, because if there's not enough space taken up with these conversations around, you know, in inverted commas, what it is to be a man and where masculinity falls, if we don't do it, the vacuum just continues to exist, and then we get problems. So I'm just really grateful that we're doing this.
I think the sort of finishing off the idea of, if there are young men listening, I think going and finding your role models that you want to be like, I think but also really looking at, like, what is their overall, what's going on around them. When I was a young athlete, I was driven by role models. I was driven by these ideas of people I wanted to be like, but also it was the character. It wasn't what they were achieving that was what I was actually striving after. I look at it and I go, it was the character that they were trying to be. And one thing actually that came up in your podcast, and Fraser said it, was the phrase to young men of saying, you are enough. Now, I'm a big proponent of you are enough to have a crack at what you're doing. But there is almost another side of that by saying, well, maybe where you are right now, maybe you're not good enough as you are, in the sense that you can be better. You can be more. You can go after and create a character. You get the choice now to turn into this character that you want to become. Rather than if you are, but because there will be many people listening that potentially are unhappy in where they are. They're unhappy with the type of person they are, which I think is an incredible platform to then be able to say, right, I want to make choices that are for the right version of me. Look at your story of where you have been, the dark times you've been through. If you had not decided to change yourself in those moments, you would be in a completely different world right now. But it's the choice of the character, the type of person you want to be, that is exciting. It's an exciting prospect for people, but you do need those guides. You need those role models to look up to aspire to be like, more from who they are rather than what they're achieving.
And what I just add to that is, there's that little voice in you And during my difficult times and when I was behaving in ways that I didn't want to behave like, there was a little voice in me going, this isn't quite right. You know, there's a little nagging doubt, this isn't quite right. And I listened to that little voice, you know, in all of us, that it's that, I don't know what it is. It's our, you know, our instinct, our consciousness. I'm not sure, but it's something that's saying, no, I don't like this. Listen to it. And then you can live your reality. You can be the man you want to be. You know, I know we're focusing on men, but this applies to everyone. You can absolutely go and live and be the person that you would like the person to see. I know that sounds really obvious. You're not trapped as a person. You can go, I don't like where I'm at the moment. I want to be this type of person, and then go and live it. You know, I want to be someone who always lives with 100% integrity. Go and live with 100% integrity. You can do it. You know, I want to be someone who's a really, really reliable friend. Well, go and be it. It's possible. You just have to listen to that voice and then step out and do it. So I wish people good luck with that.
Mate, I love that. What an ending today. I absolutely love that. I'm going to leave links in the show notes for everything that you've got going on, where people can go chase the podcast, listen to it. Really encourage people to go onto it. Thank you for starting it. I know we're in a WhatsApp group of a bunch of people who are already getting value from it. But great job, and thank you for coming back.
Pleasure. Been really good. I really enjoyed it.